Welcome, everybody. Good Life Housing Partners. It is our weekly podcast. Today is Tuesday, March 26, 2024. This is episode 144, and we're getting started on a busy day here. But we're going to do a question and answer session. We've had these pile up in our mailbag, and we figured we'd get to these first. It's been a busy week on the gambling scene. Shohei Ohtani seemingly loves some soccer betting, and seems like there are other athletes that are now caught up in the gambling fracas that is starting to occur all over the American sports leagues. Sadly, my compadre, David Fong, is still on the road out there and won't be joining us for today's question and answers. So all you're going to get is my question and answers. So let me start with this. But yes, the gambling thing is very interesting. I'm looking forward to talking more about it with David once he returns hopefully in the next week or so. So, okay, got some questions here. And the first question is from Julie in Montana. And is what point does hiring a third-party property management company become necessary for student housing assets? And actually, I think it's a great question. And I think what I'll do is I'll answer this in a more, interesting way, in a more general way, really, is when does third property management just become necessary for any type of asset? And I think it really becomes necessary when one of two things happens. One is when you have a asset that requires a considerable amount of human interaction, and that you need to basically have a lot of touch points. You need to, I don't think there's a lot of rent collection per se anymore. There's not a lot of, unless you're managing a hotel, there's not a lot of daily transactional volume. That, you know, it's not like a cash register, but there are just things that require people to expend time either going through, like, you know, payables and receivables, or there is just work that needs to be done at the property level, whether it be renovating an apartment building or be, doing some necessary deferred maintenance work, things of that nature that require somebody to kind of oversee this work. And I think that's important to think about when you're looking at third property management, because when you're bringing those types of folks in, they really become an extension of you, is what you're really hoping for. And your hope is that they will run the property as somebody who owns the property would run it. And in some ways, this can actually be that they will run it better because they have less emotional tie to the property. They're more business-like. They're obviously going to ideally spending more time focused on the assets. They should have some systems in place where they're going to be well versed in how to run the asset. And so, when this works, it can work really well. You can have somebody come in with the third party property management company, whether it be on the apartment or student housing side, like a Graystar that has both market rate multifamily as well as student housing, that has a very robust platform. And when you have, I think you have newer assets, they have an excellent system of how to keep those assets performing at very high levels, not only from an occupancy, but also from a rents and collections and just overall asset performance standpoint. They're one of the best in the business, and they've made a lot of investments in systems and technology and people to make sure those things are happening, and they're happening continuously. So I think to the original question is, when do you bring it in? Is really when you no longer have the time, or you realize that you trying to do it on your own is taking away from something else that you should be doing that probably is more important to what you need to do. Like that those problems are starting to become overwhelm some of the more important things that you should be doing, and you need to bring in somebody, a third party, to run it. That's I think the number one reason is why you bring third party. The secondary reason to bring in third party property management is sometimes what I've seen, especially when people have larger portfolios of assets, whether it be student housing or market rate multifamily or anything for that matter, and they really want to separate their organization, which is usually more a development or acquisition driven organization, from the day-to-day management of the asset. And so they'll bring in a third party to run that portion of it. So they don't really have to think about it. And then typically, this is how we're structured, they'll bring an asset management person to really interface on a very regular basis with those property management companies. So I think that that's really when you're saying, I'm not going to hire these folks and put them under my umbrella. I want the separation from my company or from my portfolio, and to bring in third party. And there's a number of reasons why people do it. It's legal. It could be labor driven. It could be staffing. There are a variety of reasons I've heard through the years of why, for the second reason why you hire a third party. But the main point being that you're separating the property management from your organization's main goal, which is usually tends to be either an acquisition and growth of the portfolio or development of new projects or both. So yes, I hope that answered your question, Julie, but that's what I think, a very long-winded answer of why you bring third-party property management. And sometimes it doesn't make sense at all. Sometimes you want to be able to continue to run that asset and do it on your own. You want to be really close to the performance and really be involved in. And that's great too. If you have the time to do it, nobody's going to spend more time and care more about the asset, whether it be student or apartments or anything for matter, than you will, because you own it and it directly affects your goals for the property. It's a good one. This is from Frank in Houston, Texas. It was just there. How do you stay informed about local real estate market trends and changes? It's funny. It used to be there was a number of periodicals that were asset driven, which we still get, whether it be affordable housing or student housing or market rate housing or industrial. Every asset type has some sort of periodical. Largely, most of them now are used to be print. Now, most of them have a digital version, but I think we get both sent to this office. So we have a ton of stuff on a monthly basis that comes through here. And those are good. I think, to be honest, those tend to be a little bit behind like actual real-time trends. They tend to be like a month behind. And I think they even realize that. So more of it is driven in those periodicals about, you know, kind of more general stories or pieces about people and what they're doing in the industry or about a company and what, you know, what they're seeing or their projects. So they tend to be more focused on the actual people involved in real estate or the companies involved and what the projects are. I think nowadays there's a bunch of newsletters, you know, Commercial Real Estate Daily. There's an Market Rate Multifamily Daily, Multifamily Dive. There's a host of these that come on a daily basis that have a ton of stuff that's happening in the markets and what's going on, much more real time. The Real Deal is a big one that a lot of people subscribe to. Some of these are paid, like The Real Deal. And then you can get a ton of very current information, at least for a fairly slow-moving industry, by subscribing to these. And as I said, some are paid and some are unpaid. Good question, though. This has really changed in the last 10 years, the ability to stay on top of these things. This is a question from Omar in Waxahachie, Texas. Wow, okay. Is there a lot of potential for conversion of office space into data centers? I'll take a more general look at this. I think office, by now, most people understand, is a very difficult asset class. It's really hard to figure out how it's going to work. There has been quite a bit of talk recently that office is sort of coming back and you're starting to see it refill in certain areas. Personally, I haven't seen a lot of this, and I'm not 100% sure that that's fully true. But I do see pockets where office does seem to be working well. Those tend to be nicer parts of the city. Those tend to have quite a bit of amenities. Those almost definitely are very safe. They're usually, they're either really in two things. They're either one is they're in large metros and very, very choice parts of the city that people want to be in. Whether there was offices or not there, people would go there. So they're almost, you know, going there regardless whether there's office. If there's office, then people are going there for long periods of time because they tend to office there. Or they're in secondary or tertiary places where there is less of a work from home culture for a number of reasons, usually around, it starts with commuting and then it works its way down from there. But commuting in bigger cities is much more challenging than, let's just say, Boise, Idaho, or even, you know, Kansas City. These are much easier places to get around. They're much more spread out cities. There's a lot less congestion. And going into the office is not really a question. It's more of people actually prefer it in a lot of ways, and it's not hard to get to. So it's sort of an expectation. Converting office, I think, is more or less, nobody seems to, at least in the last 2-3 years, as this has become more and more prevalent, that office has become a little bit obsolete. It doesn't seem to be anybody that has found what is going to make it functional anymore. I think the idea of data centers is great. I think with all these conversions, it takes quite a bit of capital to convert essentially space that doesn't have a lot of plumbing, space that doesn't have, that has, you know, HVAC that's required for human, for a certain amount of human capacity, space that doesn't generally have operable windows, space that has been office for a very long time, or even not a long time, to convert it into something like data centers where you need heavy duty HVAC, where you need a number of, you need really open space from what I've understood, or closed space, you need controlled environments. You need a lot of things that cost a lot of money. And I think once you start, and I think this is almost with any conversion of any type, but specifically office, once you start getting into what the costs are of what it's going to take to convert something like office to multifamily or to data centers, it quickly becomes like, is this all even worth it? And I think that's why you haven't seen that many office buildings being converted to data centers, because I think it becomes, is this even worth it? Why don't we just build it from scratch? It'll be actually easier. We might see more of it. As some of this stuff defaults, you'll start to see things happen on this front. Like, people are going to have to do other things to make this product and space and land use viable. And if it's an office, it'll be something else. So that does work. Do you recommend investing through crowdfunding services for someone's first commercial real estate investment as a limited partner? And this is from Christy in Reno. Christy, I am not sure. I would have told you 4 or 5 years ago that was probably fine. Your invested amount is fairly small. I think recently we've seen a number of crowdfunding services or platforms have some really difficult issues. The Nightingale scandal was probably being the biggest, but I think that the entry point is so low that it makes it easy, but I would almost say like things like Blackstone's BREIT, which I think is also a fairly low entry point. It's actually, I think it's a very low entry point. That's probably just a better bet for now, because unless you really believe in the sponsor or the project, or ideally both, you're almost better off with smaller amounts of capital, with small to you, whatever that means, going into something that's much more proven to get the exposure. Just because they're, you know, I think going with sponsors on a lot of these platforms is now, even though I think only like a very small percentage of them have actually not, have like completely blown up and say not doing well, but from what we know, like made headline blow up. I still think now it's like more challenging, especially if you don't know the sponsor or they have like they don't have much of a track record. And I think the environment's tough too. Like, it's very difficult to really tell where things are going in the real estate market. I mean, we have been waiting for rate cuts for now well over a year plus, and I think those are coming and those are going to be helpful, but I don't think they're going to change the tide of the industry all of a sudden either. So I think, you know, crowdfunding services are great, but you have to be very careful. And really be focused on the sponsor and the project before moving forward? That was a great question, Chrissy. Thank you. What are some of your main investing criteria for development deals, especially those in secondary or tertiary markets? And this is from Juan in Puerto Rico. It's a great question. I don't know if Puerto Rico is a secondary or tertiary market. I think it's probably tertiary, but it has a lot of interesting things going on. But I think you were asking more in just a general sense, what are main investing criteria? So I think one of the most basic criteria you can look at is when you, whatever you build, let's just say apartments for easy conversation, that apartment should get a premium because it's new and it's going to be brand new. It's going to have, you know, modern finishes, modern technology, modern building standards. It's going to be a very nice new building. And you need to make sure that the apartment is going to get a premium and that people can pay for that premium. And you'll see this quite often in areas, you know, even primary cities, but definitely in secondary, tertiary cities where you can't really, while it makes sense to build in certain places because there is a housing need, there's a housing supply shortage, a lot of times it doesn't make sense because the cost of building is going to be so high or is substantially higher. Well, it's that the cost of building is high enough where you're going to need certain types of rents that are going to be substantially higher than the existing housing stock. And so much so that most people won't be able to pay for that additional cost. So if you, let's just say for conversation, if you're renting an apartment for $1,000 in Wichita, Kansas, and that's $1 a foot, so $1,000, 1,000 square foot apartment, $1 a foot, and then you build a brand new apartment and it's 800 square feet, but it's got like a much better floor plan, it's got brand new appliances, and now you need, let's just say, $2 a foot, and it's $1,600. That delta, that $1,600 for the local rental environment, for the local renter in Wichita, it may not, depending where you are, Juan, it may not sound like a lot of money, but for that environment, there may not be enough renters that, one, want to pay $1,600, or two, don't have the budget to afford $1,600. But in either case, you're in a position where trying to get renters to pay this additional sum is very challenging or is almost impossible. And that's where, you know, that's the most basic criteria we look at. Can the local market that we're building, especially if it's a secondary tertiary city, support the rents we are going to need to make this project profitable and thereby viable? I think you can very quickly do this little exercise and understand like if it's there or not for you. And I think that's important. Like I'll give you a very good example that's very pertinent. It's we're finishing now a project in Oklahoma City, which is definitely a secondary market. And even though it's in the downtown and it's got checks a number of boxes, we were very careful and we were very particular about how we were going to set the rents here. And we ended up going with smaller apartments because our belief, and we'll find out how correct we were very quickly now, is that we were better off building smaller apartments that were going to have a lower sticker price, like a lower rental price. And even though our rent per square foot would be at or even higher than some of our competitors that are also new products, because our sticker price would remain lower below where they were, we felt like this would be a very competitive product. And this is, you know, there's a number of other things going on. It was very urban infill. It was a really growing part of the city. It was part of the city where people want to live. So there's a bunch of other stuff there. But the most important was that we wanted to be at a price tag where people would really consider living because that price tag was very competitive, either A, to where they were living, or B, to where they were looking, hopefully in Oklahoma City. But even if they were to extend out and say, well, I'm looking at the same apartment or same living situation in Dallas or in Houston or wherever, this would be a very competitive rent. So that I think that's really where you should start. And then everything else kind of filters behind that. All right. I'm going to try to do a couple more here. We're already hitting the 20-minute mark. Let me see what I got. Let's see here. All right. What are some major tax implications of investing out of state as a general partner in a non-development deal? It's a great question. We come across this all the time. And I'm going to preface this by saying that everything I say here is just my own little viewpoint of investing as a GP. It's not tax advice and should not be used as tax advice. Please go consult your CPA if you're a general partner looking at out-of-state development deals. But in general, depends on what state you're at. If your state has a state income tax, and again, this is totally dependent on your state, but we're based in California. California is a very aggressive state when it comes to earning income, and they have a 13% tax here. And any income that you earn, as long as you're a California resident, will get taxed. And so you have to be, as a general partner, you obviously are taking on quite a bit of responsibility, not only from being generally the guarantor in the development deal, or conversion guarantee, or loan guarantee, whatever it may be, but you also have a lot of other responsibilities. And so sometimes you can earn additional carry for doing the deal, and that will also get taxed. And usually, I'm just thinking on a state level. On a federal level, it's all the same. It's going to be the same federal taxes, whether you're in California or North Dakota or Connecticut. It doesn't make a difference. That's federal. But state can definitely change, and different states are going to tax you differently. And so you just have to be cognizant of how that's going to affect your bottom line, or when you exit the project, or even as you're cash flowing the project. It's important. So that's a great question. A final question. This is a good one. What is your experience been like with the 1031 program? And this is from international. Wow. This is from John in Finland. John, how are you in the 1031 program? That's amazing. All right, well, John, I don't know what type of 1031 you're doing, but the program is great. Basically, 1031 program allows you to take your gains from a sale of a real estate investment and then take that money and move it to another investment tax-free, as long as that investment is the same or more than what you previously invested in. That's the basics of it. And there's a bunch of rules. You've got a certain timeline. You've got to identify in 45 or 60 days. You have 180 days to complete the transaction. There's a number of things that go into this 1031 program. But the basic idea is that you're deferring your taxes, your capital gains taxes, your taxes in general, by electing to do a 1031. And the program itself is great. It saves a lot of money in taxes. It keeps the velocity of a fairly slow-moving industry like real estate. It keeps the transaction velocity fairly high and moving hopefully quickly. And so this is important in an industry that moves, that is by nature, the selling of businesses, the selling of real estate, the development property is a very slow moving game. And programs like 1031 actually help to accelerate it by forcing people to say, okay, we have this, we sold this building or we sold these apartments and now we want to buy something else. We have, this period, we need to sign something and we got to close it within 6 months. And so it's an important part of our real estate industry. And I think actually, in a lot of ways, it's very attractive for a lot of people because it allows you to be sheltered from taxes. And while at the same time, you're reinvesting that capital. And generally, when capital is invested, it creates sort of, there's an energetic effect that happens. And so, I'm going a little bit on a tangent, but I think it's important that capital is constantly invested. When you see capital stop being invested, that's when you can get into periods of stagnant growth, a lot of people are using the word stagflation today, but when things are stagnant, that's when things can, economies, companies, people just tend to sort of like get stuck. And it's important that you have things that are moving. And you know, we try to be a fairly transactional firm. It's not easy all the time, but things like 1031 can sometimes be a necessary bump. The attraction of tax savings can sometimes help spur you into doing, getting into another project, getting into another deal. Now, all that being said, I've sort of given you the very positive spin of 1031. Obviously, we've used it. We've used it, I think, fairly well. There is this other side of it that's not as great, is that you have like real limitations, specifically from a time standpoint of when you need to redeploy that capital. And you will, you know, you talk to even just a handful of real estate investors, anybody that's used the 1031 program, you will hear about some nightmare, about somebody selling something, they wanted to exchange, and they ended up, because they were such in a time crunch, they ended up rushing and they bought something they didn't want to buy, or they bought something that they shouldn't have bought. And I think you hear about that, you know, with not all the time, but there is a very strong, very vocal side of this that is true, that the 1031s occasionally will force people into making or buying a project or deal that isn't, it's not great. And I think that can be a very challenging part of this because of where you are in the times in terms of timing. So this is a great question. I don't know what you're doing in Finland that you need 1031 advice, John, but I like it. So keep them coming, folks. This is a short episode, kind of just a filler until David is back, but appreciate everyone joining in. Thank you for all the questions, guys. Sorry I couldn't get to all of them, and we'll be back with you soon. Thank you.